This is the Happy Rant Sports Podcast, in which Ted Cluck and Barnabas Piper rant about old sports, new sports, sports books, sports movies, and anything else related to sports that they feel like. Enjoy.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Sports Podcast. I am Ted Cluck, joined, as always, in studio by my good friend and my partner in sports radio, Barnabas Piper. Pipe, it is one day. We're less than 24 hours away from the start of the NFL playoffs. We've got two complete days worth of playoff games on tap for tomorrow. So we wanted to kind of do a recap on some of our takes from early in the NFL season, see where we were right, see where we were wrong, talk about the Deshaun Watson sweepstakes, some of the rebuilds that are coming in the NFL. But before we do that, I want to ask you a little bit about the NBA, because I've watched 0 minutes of NBA basketball this season. And it seems like last NBA season ended 25 minutes ago. So
it was 28 minutes ago, but you know, not far off.
Yeah, to be fair. I've not had my usual motivation or interest in flipping on any NBA basketball. So my first question to you is, are they playing in like real arenas, or are they doing the like, you know, auxiliary gym at Disney thing like they were doing last year?
No, they're playing in real arenas, but it's really weird because there's almost none of the arenas are allowing fans for obvious reasons. And but they still have like the full in arena experience going on. So like they'll pan empty crowds, so it's all a tarped over seats, and then you'll get to like the balconies where they have the dancers and the DJ and the mascot doing their full on like get the crowd that's not there hyped up thing.
That's bizarre, dude.
And then they pipe in some crowd noise, but what you don't get any of is like the ambient noise, you know, of like the squeaking sneakers and the bouncing ball and that kind of thing, which is probably because if they mic'd the court, all you would hear is the players trash talking and cussing at each other. And
exactly.
That's not real good advertising for most people.
Which I think they should lean hard into that. I think there should be like an HBO Max option on the NBA telecast where you can get all the trash talk.
Yeah, you need to get like the broadcast version or like the unfiltered version.
Totally.
Where you can get the, you know, like when they did the Jordan documentary, you could get the, what was it, Netflix.
Oh yeah, you could get the like unfiltered Jordan version.
Yeah, and then you get the ESPN one where it was all bleeped out.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we need the not bleeped out version so that we can hear just, you know, exactly how crazy, I don't know, Kyrie Irving is on the court or something.
Exactly, man. That would be so fun. And it would be a means of providing something new in a moment where, like, all kinds of things are being taken away, right? So you're losing all the energy of an actual gym. Even the ambient noise of like the ball hitting the floor and the sneakers. I'm a big fan of that. Like call me old fashioned. I'd like to hear all that stuff. Okay. Next question. On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most, 1 being the least about the NBA, what's the level of like social sermonizing that you get in a given telecast? 'Cause it was like an 8 or a 9 last year and it was consistent. Like how much are you being preached at in an average NBA telecast in this season?
I'm mostly streaming it through the NBA League Pass to watch like local broadcasts. I haven't tuned into a ton of like the TNT ESPN games. I'm sure those are worse because, you know, they have to have their personas in place. Whereas like watching Jim Peterson do color commentary for the Timberwolves, he's much more distraught about D'Angelo Russell's inability to play help defense or something like that, which thankfully I'm with him on that. I'm much more distraught about that as well. So I'm sure it's bad. Although I haven't seen a lot of like, you know, there hasn't been a lot of publicity about the protests and things like that. I know the night of the riots at the Capitol, a couple different teams, especially I think it was Washington and their opponent, you know, took a knee on the court and that kind of thing. But so that feels fairly par for the course at this point.
Sure.
It hasn't been shoved down the throat the way that it was previously, as far as I can tell.
That's good. Yeah, the NBA kind of alluded to not shoving that down people's throats to the degree that they did last year. Dude, shout out to local broadcasters. I feel like local broadcasts are the best for the NBA.
Some of them are so horrendous they're good. You know, yes. Where you're like, oh, this is just a gong show of homerism. And then some of them are sneaky, really good broadcasters.
Yeah, definitely, dude. Definitely. And they're not so into their personas like you said with the national broadcasts. We had this guy in Detroit for like 150 years, George Blaha. And it was always Blaha and Greg Kelser doing the local Pistons feed. And just kind of local legends in that market.
Or like when Tommy Heinsohn did the Boston one, and he was just convinced that every Celtics up-and-comer was like the next Bill Russell, you know?
Absolutely.
And it was just all stories of when he played. And he was a great player back in the day. But yeah, he was such a homer. It was hilarious.
Yeah, for sure, dude. For sure. So how are the Timberwolves this year?
They're horrendous. They need to fire their coach. And so their best player, Karl-Anthony Towns, got a wrist injury. And so he's been out after the first couple games of the season. Mm. And they look like they're completely lost without him. And he wasn't good enough to make them, you know, a great team anyway. But sure. I mean, they've gotten blown out by like 15 to 30 points in, I think, 4 or 5 straight games.
Ouch.
Which, no matter who you are as an NBA team, that means the coach needs to get fired. Because that's
just...
There's just
the NBA is always quick on the... They're always quick on the trigger with these head coaches.
See, here's the thing, though. So Ryan Saunders is their head coach. He was a beloved assistant for a long time. He's the son of Flip Saunders, who was the only successful... Well, I guess there was a couple other good seasons here and there. Rick Adelman had a couple of good years. Tom Thibodeau had a good year. But Flip is the most successful coach in Timberwolves history. Coached the majority of Kevin Garnett's career at Minnesota. Yeah. Flip passed away, I think, in 2014.
Yeah.
So Ryan's his son. And so there's like this, we can't fire him. That's mean to the Saunders legacy. And frankly, I think letting the son coach the team into the ground is bad for the Saunders legacy.
That is true as well. Dude, to me, it's a question of names with those two. Ryan is not a sports name. I'm sorry. It just doesn't work.
It doesn't like hockey.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I guess I'm not thinking about hockey.
Like Ryan Saunders sounds like a great defenseman for the St. Louis Blues.
Yeah. You could be a third line kind of defenseman, kind of a grinder, you know, a little bit of a goon. But Flip Saunders, I can get behind the name Flip Saunders. I feel like if that's your name, like some grit has been, passed to you via the name. And, it's kind of a fun name. It's kind of a show business name. You know, Flip Saunders could work in the movie business, radio. Ryan Saunders, man, just tough. It's kind of forgettable. You know what I mean?
If you're a 50-something-year-old man and you're still going by Flip, like
you've got some swagger.
Yeah, there's something about you that's kind of uniquely, like, you just stand out from the crowd. Mm-hmm. You know, at that point, usually you go by Phil, not Flip. Yeah. But nope, he kept Flip all the way to the end.
Was that his Christian name, Phil? Phil Saunders?
I think it was Phil Saunders.
Phil Saunders sells you like homeowner's insurance.
Yeah, he's the local State Farm agent advertised at the Timberwolves games.
Advertised at the Timberwolves games on the little billboard. You know, hey, call Phil Saunders for all your home, auto, and life insurance needs in the greater Minneapolis, St. Paul area. Yeah, dude, I hope that gets better for you. I really do. And we've got baseball, you know, coming in the not too distant future, I hope. But what we want to do today, Pipe, is talk a little NFL. And you had a great idea yesterday in the pre-show production meeting. You wanted to talk about takes that we were wrong on from the beginning of the season. And I thought that was just great because there are a lot of them for me. But I'm going to let you kick us off. What was one take that you were just wrong on going into the season?
Okay, so there's two that come to mind that I just a huge swing and a miss for me, but I'm going to go with all things Buffalo Bills first.
Yeah.
When Josh Allen was drafted, whatever that was, 3 years ago, I just guffawed at the pick. And I think we talked about it on this podcast. I think a listener even like sent me a link to that episode and was like, how are you feeling about this now?
Accountability from our listeners.
Well, I mean, if you record it, somebody can go dig it up and make you look like an idiot for it. So
that's true.
I just thought he was going to be a dog of a player. And this year he's an MVP candidate.
Yeah.
And then to top that off, when the Vikings traded Stephon Diggs to the Bills, I was like, good luck with a quarterback who's going to throw the ball into the stands every time. And thought like by week five, he'd throw a temper tantrum. And instead, he led the league in catches and is one of the top yardage guys and has been legitimately one of the top two or three receivers in the NFL this year. Those two things go hand in hand. Both players have shown who they are. And I was completely wrong about them. Yeah. And here's the thing. I'm glad I was wrong because watching a young quarterback turn good is so fun. And I don't hate Stephon Diggs. I kind of hate how he handled things in Minnesota, but like he's a really fun player to watch. So I'm not mad about any of this. I was very wrong about it.
No, that's a great one, man, to start with. And I think, you know, the old adage with quarterbacks has always been, you can't teach accuracy, right? Like you can't improve a guy's accuracy. And that was the knock on Josh Allen. But you know, we're squarely in the like play design era of NFL coaching. And I think you can play design accuracy. You can scheme guys open. And in fact, more and more, you know, more of these quarterbacks that come out of college than not, you do have to scheme players open for them. I mean, Baker Mayfield isn't throwing guys open, right? Jared Goff isn't throwing guys open. The list goes on and on. The litany of guys that you have to really scheme a receiver open for. And I think adding Stephon Diggs into that mix as another guy who can get open, it just put them over the top, you know, and they've done a really good job with it. And there's a dark underbelly to the play design era of coaching as well, which is, I think you lose some of that natural game flow, go with what works kind of motif as guys are just, you know, they're going to the game with a laminated play sheet of 250 plays and they feel like they have to call all of them. You know, that's kind of the dark side of the play design era, but it has worked for Josh Allen. It's worked for the Bills. Right, man. They're a fun team to watch.
I heard a really, what I thought was a really insightful take. It was from Robert Mays. He was talking to Nate Tice on the Athletic Football Podcast. I don't know if you subscribe to that one, but
I don't subscribe, but I listen from time to time.
Yeah, Robert Mays has for the last several years been one of my favorite NFL podcasters because he's a really smart guy, but you can tell he really has fun with the game. He's a little bit like Zach Lowe is to the NBA. But Mays was talking about how in this era of, you know, highly schemed offenses, I guess the quarterback ratings, whatever rating they were using, this year, something like 2/3 of the league was higher than, you know, in the mid 90s, 5 quarterbacks reached whatever it was, a QBR of 95. This year, 22 quarterbacks did or something like that.
Wow.
And so he said, how do you stand out as a quarterback in a league where even below average is above average?
Right.
And he was talking about Josh Allen and he said, well, you have to go take the risk on the unique talent and see if you know if that's the thing that pushes you above. Like Kirk Cousins is an above average quarterback by those ratings, except we all know that he's not. Like he's exactly
he puts so many of the good numbers together in the fourth quarter in games that they're losing that don't matter.
Yeah, he's fine as a talent, but he's not great. Whereas like Josh Allen has something, and if he continues to progress, Patrick Mahomes has something. Aaron Rodgers obviously has something. Those guys were like, it's the schemed offense, but that special athletic talent, that special arm, that special kind
of,
you know, FU attitude where they just don't ever get afraid of anything. And I just thought that was interesting because we've talked about it before too, how all these like quarterback camp guys come in.
Yep.
And they look like Kirk Cousins. Like when everything is on schedule and perfect, they're good. But the moment you make them have to overcome a hurdle, they look kind of crappy. And then the special guys are the ones who make the plays that shouldn't be made.
That's right. That's a great point. And along those lines, here's one that I was dead wrong on. Justin Herbert as a prospect.
Oh, he was my second one. We both thought he was just trash.
Well, dude, let's talk about it. And I want to talk about why we thought he was going to be trash, because to me, he didn't have the kind of alpha dog quality. He didn't have the FU kind of vibe that the great ones seemed to have as a competitor. He didn't have, to me, like the signature college game that you throw in and you go, oh yeah, this guy's an alpha. This guy's, you know, he's able to dig himself out of problems that present themselves on the field. And he did have, though, and I think this speaks to your previous point, he has physical freakiness.
Yeah.
And I think the Chargers rolled the dice on the physical freakiness. And boy, here we are 16 games later. The guy was sensational. And you and I were dead wrong on it. And I'm really surprised, not because I consider myself like a great evaluator, but to me, Herbert just felt like one of those guys that we were rocketing up the draft board because we needed quarterbacks at the top of the draft board. And I was dead wrong. What are your thoughts on it, Pipe?
Yeah, I think we were fooled a little bit because I think he was in a really bad offense at Oregon. Like one of these, like he threw more screen passes than anybody else. They weren't letting him do like what Trevor Lawrence has been able to do, where the offense is in his hands. He goes and makes plays. So kind of everything that's good about him, he's the best deep ball thrower in the NFL this year, I think, by some metrics.
Yeah.
I don't think he threw the ball downfield at Oregon at all. So
no, you're right.
You get all of those things. And so, I think there was some suppression there. But then I think I bought into subconsciously what you mentioned, which is like quarterbacks need to have a certain persona to I feel a little bit like, you know, someone's grandpa being like, he needs to, you know, eat nails to be a good quarterback or something.
Totally, totally.
But realizing, forgetting that like confidence can look like, you know, Michael Jordan and all of his swagger. Or it can look like Kawhi Leonard and his just like, or Tim Duncan, just like the complete Iceman aspect of things where like they just don't show emotion. And, you know, football is a very aggressive game. And so stereotypically you want the screamer, the headbutter. But maybe a quarterback having a guy who's just like every time he makes a bad play, he's like, what bad play? What are you talking about? And just moves 100%. On to the next thing is – and so, I mean, Herbert's young, but he – he completely surpassed everything. He was definitely my second terrible prediction I was going to throw out there for myself.
Dude, the thing I noticed about Herbert right away, and was it week one that he got the start or week two? It was real early in the season when Tyrod Taylor couldn't go. They told Herbert like minutes before kickoff that he was going to start. And I remember watching his first few series going, he understands when to run. You know what I mean? So a lot of young quarterbacks who can run will just run all the time. Or when the first read's not there, they'll just take off. But Herbert, like almost from the drop, had a really innate sense of when to use the legs, when to stay in the pocket. He's got a really good release. He's got a really strong arm. He's got so many qualities in retrospect that like I think we weren't seeing because of where he played college football. And I think he was really held back by that. So one that we were both wrong on. Do you have a next one, Pipe?
I'm trying to think. I'm trying to think if there was any that I was just like team predictions who I thought were going to be great and ended up being bad.
Yeah.
I think I was wrong on Tampa Bay.
Okay. Talk about that.
I don't think I was as wrong because I didn't like plant my flag on this, but I thought Tampa Bay was going to be like 8-8, you know? And just maybe fight for a wild card spot kind of thing. I thought Tom Brady needed Bill Belichick more than Belichick needed Brady.
Sure.
And speaking of Bill Belichick, this will be like a 3B to my 3A. I was wrong about Belichick and Cam Newton. I thought Belichick's coaching would lift the quarterback more than the quarterback lifted Bill Belichick. Now, I think Belichick's still a great coach, but I didn't realize how much that was like an equal partnership. So wrong about Brady and the Bucks, and then as a result was wrong about the Pats and Cam Newton.
Dude, can we do a minute on Cam? I want to ask you a question about next season. So I have a friend that I talk football with all the time, and he's convinced that there will be a market for Cam Newton next year with all the quarterback movement that we're about to have. I am convinced that there will be no market for Cam Newton. I think this was the season that a lot of late career quarterbacks have where it's obvious that like they are done. I don't think there's going to be a starting job for him next year in any form or fashion. Where are you at on that?
So I think Cam Newton is the Allen Iverson of football, which is incredibly dominant and controversial in at his peak, but he depended entirely on, I mean, his skill, like he doesn't have the kind of skill set that can erode and he can make up for it.
Right.
You know, so
yeah,
his shoulder is not healthy and he looks like garbage. But the other thing he has in common with Iverson is the inability to say, I'll go be a backup somewhere. I'll take a lesser role. He's like, he is the man or he's not a man. And I mean, now Cam could prove me wrong in that because he's not old. He's like 32, something like that.
Yeah.
And which in quarterback years is young. So, but yeah, I think he's Iverson, which means that now that I don't know that he's lost running ability, but he's lost the ability to pass off of his running ability.
Sure.
Which means he's just not that valuable. He's, you know.
Yeah.
You'd rather have like Jalen Hurts for 300,000 than Cam for seven figures.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think he's like we've talked about with a lot of old prize fighters, like he has a style that doesn't age well. And also I think with a lot of these guys that rely on physicality, you know, the tools might still be there, but they lose the ability to take a punch. You know, they lose interest in, like, you know, running 12 times a game and getting their body beat up, which who can blame them? And I think Cam's squarely in that twilight where, yeah, he might only be 32, but for a guy who with his kind of play style, it's a very old 32. And I think you're going to see that as the quarterback position kind of changes in terms of the makeup of the position. That's why you value somebody like Drew Brees or Tom Brady, who they have the ultimate, like, age well style. And I don't know if we have guys matriculating out of college who play that way anymore. So I don't know if we're going to see guys play into their 40s much, even though all the advances in nutrition and
but even the guys who are aging well, like, it's, you know, Peyton Manning played to what, 38, 39, and then he just fell off a cliff.
Like, fell off a cliff.
He was,
and he had that last season.
He was MVP, like, and then he was like Steve Walsh, you know, just couldn't throw it.
That's right. Yeah. And he had that season where you knew that the next year there wasn't going to be a market for him.
Yeah.
You know, and even the most delusional, like, Peyton Manning truther couldn't have, like, envisioned a scenario where there was a market for him. I just think
Drew Brees at 40 this year was the same thing. Like, the Saints were still won games because they have a solid defense. Peyton's a good coach. And they still have, you know, and Kamara is one of the best, kind of, he's the closest thing to Marshall Faulk we've seen in the last 15 years.
What a great comp. Absolutely.
And so they still made it work, but Brees is done. Like, if Brees was a free agent and was, you know, some other team would maybe, like, he wouldn't get the Phillip Rivers contract, the whatever 1 year, $20 million. Because people look at him and go, he can't throw 15 yards anymore.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. There's a pretty definitive end. And I think, to your point about the Bucks, I don't know that you were as wrong about them as you think you are, in the sense that up until like 2 or 3 weeks ago, there were a lot of people still wondering if the Bucks would be able to figure it out. You know what I mean? They look so jagged and so uneven and so out of sorts at times during the season. There was a real sense of, maybe this isn't going to work. And I could still honestly see them losing to the Washington football team this weekend. You know, I mean, there's a very real world in which the Bucks, you know, get into the playoffs and crap the bed. And I still don't know how much I trust Arians when it matters. You know, there's still a lot of question marks on that team, even though it looks like Brady has won the, you know, Brady Belichick face off of the 2020 season for sure.
Yeah, I think there are questions about that team, and Arians is, you know, he's always been kind of a, like, swing for the fences guy, which means that you strike out and have some really ugly outings, but then, boy, when you hit, do you hit big. You know, think about his time with the Cardinals, etc. But the thing that has stunned me is just Brady's overall production this year in terms of, I think it's like the second or third most passing touchdowns he's ever had. He's well over 4,000 yards. I just kind of thought he was going to be like 3,700, 3,800 yards, throw like 25 touchdowns and 15 picks, kind of like a mediocre Carson Palmer season. And in part because he's 44 and in part because it's Bruce Arians. And instead, he, you know, he hasn't been amazing at the beginning of the year. He took a little while. But cumulatively, he's been phenomenal. And that team just looks different than even like, you know, the versions of the Bucks we thought might be competitive in past years. Like they, they've got Brady. That's the difference. That's really the only difference. And then Tristan Wirfs, who's played great for him. But that's
He's been so good. Just the fact that we're not talking about a Brady narrative where we're asking the how do we move on from him question, you know, which I think we both thought by the end of this year we would be talking about Brady in those terms. It's pretty remarkable, and it'll be definitely fun to see what they do in the playoffs. My last one, Pipe, as far as takes that I was wrong with, this isn't necessarily one that I've been super wrong with, but I think the league continues to get it wrong. It's edge rushers mattering. You know, it's still a big story in free agency every offseason, like where are the edge rushers going to land, and Yannick Ngakoue goes to the Ravens and Khalil Mack with the Bears.
Well, the Vikings traded for him first when they were still on that, like, can we turn the season and get into playoff contention? I mean, they finished 7-9, and so
that's right.
Get two more wins, and they are a playoff team, and they got him, and he made no difference.
Well, absolutely, and there was a lot of buzz around here when the Titans signed the greatest pass rusher of all time, Jadeveon Clowney, and like he has made absolutely no difference whatsoever.
Well, he's always been overrated as a pass rusher. Totally. Like he's a monster of a human, just physically, but not a good pass rusher.
He's kind of the Bruce Arians of edge rushers, in that I think he's more the product of like marketing and a little bit of hype than actual production. These guys, you know, we continue to, you know, if you're in a certain fan base, get excited about a signing like Yannick Ngakoue, and they continue to kind of be a revolving door of names from year to year. But, you know, I think the more we think about pass rushing, and the more we think about third down, and the more we think about, as the makeup of the quarterback position changes, how we rush the passer, right? Because like when you and I played Pipe, it was always, you know, get up the field, beat your guy to the outside, but quarterbacks now are so adept at working the pocket, stepping up, sliding, throwing on the move laterally, or just running. Like, you really can't approach pass rushing that way anymore.
Well, and so much more of the passing game is lateral. So, like, if you go upfield, you're just creating throwing lanes.
You're creating throwing lanes, and you're effectively removing yourself from the play immediately. Yep. So a lot of your great defensive lines now are the defensive lines that rush more evenly, where you see four guys at the same depth, and then you force a Kyler Murray or a Baker Mayfield or a Cam Newton to kind of hesitate and make a decision. So it's really rendered the way we play offense now has really rendered the edge rusher kind of a non-thing. And, you know, you see guys that still get numbers, you know, your TJ Watts, there are still edge guys putting up numbers, but I think.
But then you see like Shaq Barrett, who I think led the league in sacks last year, gets a free agent contract this last year. And I don't think where did he sign? Is he Miami now?
He's still in Tampa, I think.
Is he?
Right?
Yeah. I don't remember. I thought he signed with a new team. But this discussion is making the point. League leader in sacks last year.
The fact that we don't know where Shaq Barrett plays is a huge thing. Yeah. So he played with Tampa this year, and let's just check his numbers from last season to this season. Hang on, this is good radio. A guy looking something up on the internet. So 19 and a half sacks last year, definitely the outlier as you look at every season of production that he's had. And he was back down to 8 this year, which isn't a bad season, but it's not a, you know.
Yeah, it's not a get paid season.
Yeah, that's right. It's not an all-pro type season by any stretch. And just for the sake of curiosity, as we make this point, let me look up Khalil Mack's numbers.
Mack has not had a great year sacks-wise. I was looking this up. Right. I don't remember the numbers, but like he's not in that like 14, 15 sack.
That's
range.
Right. He's one of those guys that I think goes to the Pro Bowl now every year just off of his reputation.
He went to the Pro Bowl. He has 9 this year.
Yeah, he has 9 sacks, 8.5 last year. Yeah, and the point that I was going to make with Khalil Mack was it feels like it's been a couple of years since he's been dominant. You know, a couple of years since he's been a guy that you've been, you know, scared of. So it begs the question, who are the great edge guys now?
So I think the great edge guys now are the guys who are their two-way players. So, and Mac actually is one of these guys. Like, he's still, he's vicious in coverage. Like, he's good at, like, covering the flat. He can drop a little bit. He's pretty solid against the run, even for
He can set the edge. For sure.
But, like, Bosa, Bosa brothers, Chase Young, those kinds of guys, you know, Calais Campbell, he's old now, but he was kind of an early version of this, where they can rush off the edge, but when they slide down inside, they can set the edge. They can still control what the offensive line does.
Yeah, that's right. So Chase Young, I'm looking at his numbers, didn't have an amazing sack season, but was really noticeable.
Yeah.
Like, if you watched any Washington games, like, he was an animal, and, you know, he was definitely a factor in terms of game planning. So, and he was on a defensive line that was really talented all the way across the front four.
They've invested a lot in it.
They really have, and they still have Ryan Kerrigan who can rush the passer. So,
but Kerrigan's another one of those guys who, like, his relevance, he's become like a spot relevant guy. He's like a good reliever instead of a good starter in baseball, where, like, if you have the right situation, he's going to be really valuable, but he's not necessarily going to dominate for the majority of a game.
He's in the late career Chris Long, New England signs him, kind of twilight of his career, which can still be a good place to be for a pass rusher. You know, you can come and be almost a relief pitcher. Charles Haley did it at the end of his career, like a handful of times, and won a bunch of Super Bowls being the off the bench pass rush guy. But
I think the new sort of unicorn that people are looking for. So, you know, it used to be the Javon Curses, the speed, or Khalil Mack at his peak, Von Miller. It's Aaron Donald now. Like, he is the, if you can find another version of Aaron Donald, you can, your defense just improves by 25% by his existence.
Yeah, that's right.
Because the quarterback can't step up. That he disrupts the running game like crazy. He's just he's a whole problem every play.
Well, and that's always been the book on, like, late career Tom Brady. Like, the only way to rattle him is to put pressure right in his face. And if you can push the pocket right up the middle, then you can affect a late career Tom Brady. And that actually, it kind of brings me to our next topic, Pipe. I want to talk about dream rebuilds and nightmare rebuilds. So, identifying a couple of teams in each category that you would see as a GM as a fun rebuild. And you mentioned the kind of the new prototype at defensive tackle, the pocket pushing, quick get off, athletic D tackle. And I actually want to talk about the Jets as a potentially dream rebuild. And Quinnen Williams is one of the pieces that plays into this in terms of being the young interior guy with a lot of twitch, a lot of athleticism, who can get sacks. He can be good in the run game. So I'm looking at the Jets, Pipe. I'm looking at, like, north of $50 million in cap space and a handful of guys that you would want to keep on the roster and build around, including Quinnen Williams.
I think they have three first-round picks. I could be wrong.
They do.
At least two.
Yeah, I mean, they're filthy rich in first-round draft picks with the added caveat of you could flip Darnold for another pick. He's not going to be a first-rounder, but you could flip him for a pick, or you could keep him and just stockpile around him. So, Mekhi Becton, we've well-documented my crush on Mekhi Becton, who by the end of next season, we could be talking about him as the best left tackle in the NFL. He had that kind of a rookie year. Quinnen Williams, Marcus May on the back end of the defense as a playmaker, Denzel Mims as a receiver, Chris Herndon, athletic tight end, and tons of picks and cap space. So they could go quarterback with that first pick. They could go another elite tackle and get an Alex Leatherwood or a Penei Sewell in the draft. I look at the Jets and I go, for as much of a dumpster fire as they were this season, it's sneakily a good situation to land in, because it was a long time before Denzel Mims got on the field and there was a long stretch with no Darnold. But toward the end of the season, they kind of started to put it together a little bit with Mims, Breshad Perriman, The other receiver there, who we've talked about before, who I'm blanking on.
The slot guy. Yeah.
Him. Yeah. Consummate him. Slot guy. Right. Right.
That guy.
But anyway, I look at that and I think, man, that could be kind of a fun rebuild. Where are you at on dream rebuilds, Pipe? Teams that you would have fun rebuilding?
So I think the obvious answer, although I don't know that this counts as a rebuild as much as just the best coaching position available, is the Chargers.
Yes. Yeah, there you
because
go.
Because they have very few I don't know how they stunk as bad as they did this year. Like they just
dude, right? You look at their position groups and they're good almost everywhere.
Yeah, they've got a great duo of receivers who complement each other along with a solid tight end. They have a good running back. You know, it'd probably be good to get a second running back who complements Eckler a little bit. I think their offensive line could use some help. When they're healthy, their defensive line is great, and they have some of the better defensive backs in football at a couple different positions. Yeah. I don't know how good their linebackers are. Like, again, we're talking the major positions. Oh, and Herbert, obviously. And somehow they were just bad. And so I don't think that's a rebuild as much as, you know, if they threw all the money at, I don't know, Urban Meyer or somebody and got a coach who can run a team, they go straight into the playoffs.
Totally.
In terms
they were in so many close games this year. They could have easily been 10-6 if they had just like learned how to finish a game.
And in terms of rebuilds, I think the Jets are the clearest case of like they need to be rebuilt. Them in Jacksonville. Where they're just not good. They don't have enough talent.
I
think Jacksonville is probably less appealing from the standpoint of they don't have a good offensive line. They don't have a good defense. They don't have weapons. They got, you know, a running back who is a nice find, but like you don't build offenses around running backs unless you're Tennessee and have, you know, a once in a generation kind of guy. But they have cap space. They don't have a lot hindering them from making good moves. So if you wanted just a blank slate, they're a good option. But the Jets have the best opportunity because they do have the left tackle. They don't have, you know, they don't need to be like, oh, we need to sign 11 receivers. They can go find a couple guys. They can, you know, if they draft a quarterback, one of the top two quarterbacks, they're great. They're in a good spot. And all those first round picks put them in a great spot because that's trade flexibility or reloading with talent. And they have cap space, which means they can make some smart veteran signings.
Yeah, they have cap space, and it's a really good, to me, it's a really good year for free agents in terms of a lot of difference makers being available. And yeah, I think the difference between the Jets and the Jags is that for the last year or two, the Jets have sneakily drafted well, and the Jags haven't. The Jags have squandered their picks by and large, and the Jets have turned them into good players or pieces that you can build around. My second dream rebuild
I think the other thing with the Jets that's a huge advantage is Adam Gase and the previous GMs, they fired their GM right after the draft, something like that.
They drafted and then they got rid of the guy.
Maybe that's to what you said. We've drafted pretty well. Let's let him do that and then not let him do anything else. But Gase has been so bad as a coach and then also just so bad as a front man for the organization that literally anybody you bring in is going to give you a long runway because they're going to be less bad as a front man and probably better as a coach.
Yeah, no, that's right. 100%. So my next dream rebuild pipe, New England. So I'm thinking about New England, and they took a beating this year, obviously, in terms of the dearth of talent on their roster. Some of that was guys that opted out because of COVID.
Hard to persuade me on this one because I'm not at all sure about that.
No, I know it. And I want to be upfront in saying that New England has drafted badly, right? Like, for all the love that we lavish on Belichick, well-deserved, and we should, like, Their draft performance has been, you know, spotty at best. But I'm looking at that team, and again, cap space kind of dovetailing with a year in which the list of free agent wide receivers this offseason is just bonkers. And, you know, we could go down the list in different price points and put a stable of weapons together for New England that they could afford that would make them competitive almost immediately. So
for who? Who's throwing the ball in this scenario?
Well, yeah, but that's the thing. I mean, it's going to be a robust quarterback trade market too. So, I mean, there could be a scenario in which Matt Stafford and Kenny Galladay end up on the Patriots next year. And you go, all right, two pretty quality young running backs, a good core of O-line talent, youth at linebacker and DB, tons of cap space to play with. And then you put like Stafford and Galladay on that team and it's a different team. You know what I mean? You could put Stafford, Galladay, and Brashad Perryman on that team. And, you know, you've got a twitchy, fast, kind of young upside guy in Perryman. You've got a guy who's produced at a high level in Galladay. And a quarterback at 32 who still has a really live arm and who I think we would both be way more excited about than a lot of other guys that they could get in the quarterback market. If they want to go young and build a quarterback, they could, you know, they could take the third round kind of Sam Darnold journey and see where that goes, which I think I was higher on, you know, last time we recorded than now. But to me, the Pats are one good offseason away from being good again. And as badly as they performed on the field this year, I think it's attributable to some things that you can pretty easily fix in the offseason. Because some of those core pieces are there. They drafted well on the offensive line last year. The kid that they got from Michigan, the rookie, looks like he's going to be a good player. Joe Tooney's coming back. David Andrews is coming back. The core is there on the offensive line. Damian Harris looks like a real player. They still have Sony Michel. You know, you put a few key pieces into that offensive mix, and I think it gets good pretty quickly. You're not so convinced on the Pats, Pipe. Why?
I feel like what they lack. So the Pats tried to kind of run it back this year, you know?
Yeah.
Change our offensive identity a little bit from the Brady driven thing to this kind of run heavy Cam Newton thing that we saw. I was stunned that they won 7 games this year. Frankly, I kind of lost track of them, and I kind of assumed that they were like 5-11 and we're going to have a top 7 pick. Instead, they're the 15th pick, which is a bummer because they could really use a higher pick than that. Now, of course, Belichick's going to flip this, move back to like get, you know, 2 high second rounders or something like that. But
right.
But I think,
dude,
I think
so just
the other piece that throws me is when have we seen Belichick rebuild, you know?
Yeah, never. That's what's fascascinating about it.
He's redefined that team a bunch of times. You know, they've been explosive offensively. They've been run heavy. They've been pass heavy. They've had star defensive players, although not as many as you would think. And then they've had these sort of like scheme dependent defenses. And what they've never done is say, we don't have an identity, which is where they are right now. And I think that's what throws me, because it's not a blank slate. It's not blank slate enough to be an obvious rebuild such as the Jets or the Jaguars.
No, that's a great point. And I think it could be more of a redefine than a rebuild. And I think that's what we're going to see this offseason. But you're right. You make a great point. Like he's never been in this situation. Which is what makes it kind of a fascinating thing to look at in terms of the Pats. And so they went 7-9. And in terms of a Mendoza line, if you will, the Vikings went 7-9 with like a way, way, way more talented roster. You know, we would look at the Vikings roster
a way, way, way more talented offense. The Vikings defense this year was heinous because they lost all their starting corners. Then their nose tackle opted out. Danielle Hunter sat out the year with an injury.
Yeah.
Anthony Barr missed most of the year with an injury, and Kendricks missed half the year. So that's like their top 5 defensive players. Not
and Ngakoue did nothing.
Yeah, and Ngakoue was there for 4 games, did nothing, and then I think he got 1 sack, and then they traded him again. So, their defense really depended on the front 7 being solid, so the young defensive backs could be good, and the front 7 was injured. And so, the New England Patriots were the photo negative of the Vikings where the defense kind of dragged the offense to 7 wins. And then for the Vikings, it was the offense being top 10 in the league numerically and the defense being horrendous.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Speaking of horrendous, there are some teams with cap situations heading into this offseason that are just nightmarish. And as a GM, I can't imagine being in a couple of these situations and trying to rebuild a team and put a product on the field for next season. As I think about nightmare rebuilds, and we can go through these quick because I still want to talk about Deshaun Watson. Detroit, terrible cap situation. All their wide receivers are free agents, except Quintez Cephus, who was a rookie last year. So Galladay, Marvin Jones, all the receivers that you've kind of gotten comfortable with in Detroit. Stafford, do you get his cap number off the books and start over? One of the most beloved players in franchise history, like, has been a Warrior, has been a Soldier, still has life in the arm, is only 32. What do you do with Stafford? Detroit seems like a nightmare, in part because some of the big swings they've taken in free agency have turned out to be big misses. Vitae is not a starting NFL offensive lineman. He's played terrible. Trey Flowers has been completely forgettable as the edge guy that you take a swing at in free agency. So the Lions have been your classic, like, throw some money at a problem and hope that we're just one or two guys away from being competitive. But they have not been that. What do you see as a nightmare rebuild pipe?
I think the Vikings are a pretty bad spot right now.
Talk about it.
I think the projection for the cap is $175 million-ish. Mm-hmm. That's what a couple of GMs were kind of projecting. They would be $8 million over the cap before making any moves.
Yeah.
They have $40 million tied up in a quarterback who is a career 500 player after like 10 seasons or something like
that. Yeah.
I don't know. He's something like 50-50 in his career.
Right.
They have a lot of money tied up in Adam Thielen, who's a good player. Uh-huh. And I mean, I don't think he's overpaid for the position, but he might be overpaid for their needs. Their offensive line, ever since like 1998, has been crap. And those tend to be expensive free agents.
Yeah.
Their defense could improve by 15 spots or something like that just by getting healthy. But they have no depth at corner. All of their corners were rookies this year or just, you know, high injury guys. Then they're about to lose their starting free safety to free agency. They can't make improvements anywhere without cutting to the bone somewhere else.
No, you're right. And that would be a tough one. You know, to me, I think you almost model that team after the like late 80s, early 90s Giants and just go, we're going to give Dalvin Cook 30 carries a game and hope he doesn't break down and take a shot play a few times a game.
Oh, I forgot to mention that in 6 years as a head coach, six years under the current coaching regime, they've had six different offensive coordinators and they're about to be on a seventh because Kubiak's retired.
Absolutely.
So
exactly.
Continuity with the offense, like Dalvin Cook was the second best running back in the NFL this year, both numerically and just eye test to Derrick Henry.
Yeah.
And, you know, they haven't signed for, I think, two or three more years. And so, you just use him up. But is that the most effective way to run an offense? Is he, you know, do you need to bring a Kubiak-like guy? Because, you know, they're kind of running that same system, which puts up numbers, but it's a very rigid offense. Like it's not creative at all.
By conventional wisdom, it doesn't make any sense to run your offense that way, especially given what we've gotten used to in terms of what the modern NFL looks like. But I think in terms of like, if you're honest with yourself and you go, there's going to be no market for Kirk Cousins, nobody wants to take on his contract. So we basically have a quarterback that we need to coach around. We need to minimize him as much as possible. And we have an unbelievable asset in Dalvin Cook. I just think you come up with a way to possess the ball and minimize Kirk Cousins and take advantage of Dalvin Cook. You know, those are the only cards that you have left to play. And if you try to like, if you try to do the normal like 2020 NFL offense thing with a new coordinator and a quarterback that you're iffy about, I just think it's not going to work. You know, you guys were, I didn't watch all the Vikings games obviously this year, but you guys were at your best when you were handing the ball to Dalvin Cook. And the offensive line seemed to be able to do that in a more significant way than they were able to do other things. So
what the offensive line can't do is straight pass protection. So running play, right. When they can run play action, they're effective. And they have a couple decent guys like Ezra Cleveland, who they drafted last year, has real potential as a probably a great guard, maybe a decent tackle. Brian O'Neill, their right tackle they drafted a couple years ago, has come into his own. And then why am I forgetting his name? The center, North Carolina State.
I like him. Bradbury. Yeah,
that guy. Bradbury improved a lot this year. But that means that they have a trash guard, and then they have Riley Reiff at left tackle, who's adequate at best and overpaid. Yeah. So they just having to coach around your quarterback is a quick way to be 6-10 to 9-7. Like that's what you've got, unless you have a great defense, and they don't anymore. So I think they go one more year of trying to fill gaps, and then they just need to start trading. So somebody like Adam Thielen, trade him for like a second round pick and a usable player. Trade Harrison Smith, trade Anthony Barr, trade whoever for picks and usable players, so that the roster has some, you know, stability, but then they can rebuild. Because until Cousins is off the books, they can't do anything.
Trapped. They're trapped. And you don't want to wait too long, like Atlanta, where a year or two ago there would have been a market for Matt Ryan and Julio Jones, where you could get like big value for those guys. But Atlanta's trapped in a kind of a cap deal similar to the Vikings.
Yeah, I think they're worse off than the Vikings in some ways. Because if you look at the Vikings, if the Vikings ran it back with the same roster plus whatever they draft, you know, they'll do a little cap restructuring and whatever.
Right.
But they get healthy, they go from 7-9 to 9-7.
That's
by getting back those guys on defense. And that's it. Whereas Atlanta just stinks.
Yeah, Atlanta's got a bunch of expensive guys that they can't move on from anymore, which is a shame because they have some young talent at offensive line, you know, that I think they could build around, but they've got to decide like if they're doing the total teardown or just the, you know, throw a little money at it. The last one I want to talk about briefly before we get to Deshaun Watson and the Texans is New Orleans. New Orleans they've perpetually been in this like, we see ourselves as Super Bowl contenders. And to be fair, I mean, they could go to the Super Bowl this year. It's not out of the question. But I think I read something where they could cut everybody on their roster and still be way over the cap heading into next season. Like, they're just in a cap nightmare.
It's because every year they roll money forward. And so, like, they have unbelievable amounts of, like, cap hits and dead money. Which, again, if you continue to roll it forward, that works while Drew Brees is a top five quarterback. It doesn't work when Drew Brees is 40 and can't throw anymore.
Right. So it's finally coming to bear that they're going to have to do something. And I just think it's going to be fascinating to see what they do because, again, as like a dork for offensive line, like they've got Ramczyk, they've got Ruiz, they've got McCoy, they've got all these like young, interesting linemen that they've invested in. They have Kamara still. So who do you decide to get off the books in New Orleans who's expensive that allows you to like not be horrible when you figure out, you know, what's going to be next at the quarterback position? I don't know. It's going to be fascinating to see
Breeze retiring will help because a retirement takes money off the books. There's no dead money. You know, I think, honestly, I think they would be wise to consider trading Kamara or Michael Thomas.
I would get rid of Michael Thomas.
I mean, I think Thomas is one of the top five receivers in the league when his head is on right. Like, he's just not guardable. But again, how much of that was Breeze? And how much, and then is his head right? I don't know what his salary is off the top of my head, but I think they signed him to an extension. which is probably pricey because receivers tend to be.
Totally. Yeah, the Saints struck me as a lot like the Vikings this year, where when they were committed to getting the ball to Kamara, they were just special because he's special. And I think you look at Kamara and Michael Thomas and you go, you know, who's the more special athlete? Who gives us the better, you know, the better chance to win if we have to ride this person? I think it's Kamara, but it's close. So yeah, while there's still a window of like getting huge value in exchange for Michael Thomas, I think you have to do it. Pipe, let's talk about Deshaun Watson, who had an incredible season on a terrible dumpster fire of a team and who all but asked for a trade this week. So we're seeing a similar arc to his Houston Texans life as we saw with DeAndre Hopkins this last early last season. What happens to Deshaun Watson? This is amazing because nobody wants to play for the Texans. There seems to be like massive dysfunctionality in their building, and they're sitting on a 25-year-old quarterback who might, you know, be one of the best at his position in the league.
See, and here's the thing. Normally I would be like, if Deshaun, so they've got him signed to an extension that is way undervalued for the talent that he is. Like, it's significantly less, I believe, than say Kirk Cousins, for example, and Watson is way better. Like we were talking about earlier, he's one of those special talents. So like there's, in a great scheme, he's going to look good just like everybody else, but then he does the stuff that takes the scheme up a level. Kind of Russell Wilson-y, except that they haven't had a great scheme because I read a stat that said they ran 6 screen passes this year, the whole year. And a screen is not the be-all, end-all of offense, but it is an indication that, like, you're thinking about how do we relieve pressure on our quarterback? How do we, you know, how do we get some easy yards? How do we kind of make the defense get on their heels a little bit and didn't do any of it?
Well, and David Johnson, the running back that they overpaid for, has traditionally been a good screen and draw type guy. So, yeah, I mean, just dysfunctionality all over the place there.
I think the problem is, normally I'd be like, they fired their coach who was also their GM. So so let's see who the new GM and coach is. But the problem is the players hate the owner because the owner is the one who a couple of years ago was like the inmates are running the asylum. You know, while we're talking about, you know, incarceration rates and all these things, and he's calling he's calling his players inmates, or at least that's how it was understood. And so I think there's just a, and then I think he's also attached to political causes the players don't like, et cetera. So yeah, there's a strong, like, we don't like this organization vibe going on there.
Yeah. It's unfortunate. And you need a GM hire potentially who could really, you know, counteract that and do culture work in the building that, you know, it doesn't look like it's going to happen. Yeah, Watson being unhappy with the new GM hire. So my question to you is, who wins the Deshaun Watson sweepstakes? Like, this was a guy that when we did our last, like, quarterback movement pod, we had no inkling that he would be anywhere near the marketplace. What does it look like? What does it take to get Deshaun Watson from the Texans? Because they have to demand a king's ransom for him.
And then thinking about other trades, like Jamal Adams had 2 or 3 firsts in his trade. Now, granted, I don't think that was a great move, but also Seattle looked at their roster and was like, we will be a playoff team or borderline consistently. So our first round picks are less valuable.
That's right.
Whereas when the Texans traded a first for Laremy Tunsil, that turned into the 3rd overall pick. If
unbelievable.
Let me see here.
Yeah. 3rd overall pick. I think you're right.
Pick. From Houston, Miami Dolphins, 10-6, get the 3rd overall pick. Boy, that's a team I'd love to be the GM of right now.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
I think Flores is a great coach. I think Tua strong potential, and they now have multiple first round picks, and they're great. So I think you're talking about probably 3 first round picks is your baseline. Just to open the conversation, which means either forfeiting future drafts or finding a team that has multiple ones this year so they can not mortgage their future, but, you know, kind of pay up front and be fine in the future, or or they have multiples next year, something like that. And I think the so the Jets are in an interesting position here because they probably are – they hold all the leverage right now.
Yeah.
They have multiple firsts. They have the second overall pick, which means that they're going to get either the BYU quarterback or the Ohio State quarterback, Fields or whatever generic white Zach dude Wilson. Name. Zach something or other. And or they can see if they can get in the Watson sweepstakes, which is interesting because it accelerates their rebuild a ton.
It does.
Because Watson in that division, if they, you know, if they draft well and sign some free agents, he doesn't break their budget because he's not overpriced as a quarterback. He's well paid, but not overpriced. He's already a top, what, six or seven quarterback in the league, probably.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you know that, so that would be an interesting one if you did like number two this year and next year's first, something like that. Just those. Yeah. So then you keep later picks, and then you know, and I with a pick as high as number two, you might be able to not go three first, but like those two, and then a second rounder and a fourth rounder or something like that. I don't know.
Right.
But it. Right. I mean, it's going to be a steep price.
Yeah, it has to be, because what happens to Houston? You know, like, do they just become one of these franchises that's perennially mired in at the bottom of the division for a decade? You know,
yeah. I mean, the other option is that Houston just keeps him. He is under contract, and then they just start trying to. So they have some contracts they can't get out of. Like, I think Randall Cobb is $10 million on the books for next year, which is just terrible. Yeah, but also then he's gone, you know?
Yeah.
David Johnson is a similar kind of thing. But again, then he's gone. You could probably trade JJ Watt. He had a healthy year this year and he still has value because he is one of those edge guys who can do inside and outside. He's not what he once was, but still a good player.
Yeah. You know, dude, I wish they had traded Watt 2 years ago.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You need to be a bit more like forward thinking on, you know, when does the drop off come for these guys? And I get it. Watt's been like, you know, Mr. Houston community, and
Bill O'Brien. I mean, forward thinking is whatever the opposite of that is what he is.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a reason why it was just, I'm going to trade the top three wide receiver in the league for a washed up running back. And you know, whatever, and then I'm gonna trade my first round pick for a really good left tackle, but like it got him 4 wins, which then handed over the pick to the other team. So I don't know what value Watt has because you know he played 16 games, only 5.5 sacks, you know, an interception, no forced fumbles, only 4 passes defensed. You know, he's
well. Not, you look at him now, and you're like, you're playing the when is he really going to get old game. You know what I mean? Like when is he truly going to be done? And it's soon.
See, I think Watt is at that. He's at the stage in his career. He's the Chris Long on the Patriots kind of thing where he can go 2 to 4 more years of being very useful as part of a well-schemed defense.
Yeah.
He can occasionally dominate a game, but he's not that guy anymore. And he's not going to be, but I think he's still paid like it.
Yeah, it would honestly be fun to see him as a reliever on a contender, you know, so one of these teams that's a guy or two away, he can come in and be the Charles Haley for somebody next year. I think that would be really interesting and probably really interesting for him because the Texans aren't going anywhere.
Okay, so the interesting thing about Watt, his contract runs through next year and it was a 6-year, $100 million contract that he signed in 2014. So, you know, he's whatever he's and the numbers tend to go up. So he's probably $20 million against the cap this year or something like that.
Yeah.
So trading him, the other team's going to have to be able to absorb a lot of money, but it probably means they don't have to give up much.
Right.
So if, you know, if the Texans wanted to get any value for him, they trade him for like a second round pick or something like that. And then the other team has to be able to absorb him. But yeah, I mean, who, like, what about Miami for him?
Totally.
You know, I mean, a team like that who's like, they're a playoff quality team.
Yeah.
But not quite there.
Exactly.
But they do seem to be forward thinking, and 1 year of Watt for $20 million might not be worth anything to them.
Yeah, it might not make sense for them. Especially when, you know, edge rushers are a little bit like running backs in that you can take dice rolls in the later rounds and find, you know, somebody who can generate 7.5 sacks in a season.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not out of the question that that guy comes from an unlikely place, I guess. And there was a time when we thought the Houston Texans had an embarrassment of riches at the edge position. You know, they had Clowney, they had J.J. Watt, they had Whitney Mercilus. Mm-hmm. You know, we looked at the Texans as like a model franchise in terms of defensive firepower, but yet the defense has never been that explosive. It's strange. Wasn't Tyrann Mathieu there at some point?
Yeah, he was there.
And he wanted out. Like it's a systemic problem in Houston where, you know, you could put a team together of guys that they've let go over the years and it would be very competitive, right?
Yeah, it's true.
It would be unbelievable. So
yeah, I mean, yeah. When you start with Clowney, Mercilus, Mathieu, and Hopkins,
yeah,
I mean, that's any team would like to have those guys at least at their, you know, at their peak
as a nucleus to build around. Yeah, at their peak. That's right.
Yeah,
you look at those four guys.
So
you go,
here's an interesting one, and I don't know. I have no idea if these numbers work out. Watson, what about Las Vegas trading for Watson? Because
interesting,
Carr is Kirk Cousins with a smaller salary, you know.
Totally, with a more tradable contract.
Yeah,
and
or cuttable. Them, like if you let him go, yeah. Who's going to cry?
Right. You give the Texans Derek Carr and a pick, and at least they have somebody.
Texas
to,
wants another Carr. I'm sure they want so.
Well, yeah, but they have somebody to like take snaps until they figure it out. You
that's
know.
Fair.
But yeah, that would be interesting for Las Vegas. I think it would be, you know, we're quickly with the Raiders kind of veering into John Gruden coaching for his job territory. And, you know, he would definitely give the offense some juice to pair with a great running back, a pretty intriguing set of, you know, young receivers. I don't know. I like it. I could see it. And if you're the Raiders, the calculus is always, how do we beat Patrick Mahomes? You know, we're in a division with the best quarterback in the league in it, and we have to come with something more than Kirk Cousins.
And they
you know
the
what
second,
I mean?
They probably have the second best tight end in the league right now. I mean, Waller's insane.
That's right.
So that is one where that might be worth mortgaging a future there. You know?
Yeah.
That, yeah. I'm trying to think of other teams where it would make any sense. Carolina, yeah. Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know that they have the picks.
The firepower to make that deal happen. But they're a team that I think could be good pretty quickly.
I mean, Watson, like Christian McCaffrey is another one of those running backs you run your offense through because he can do everything.
Yeah.
Like he, Cook, Henry, Kamara.
Right.
These are those guys. That's about it in the league.
Yeah. But Watson with Christian McCaffrey and Joe Brady calling plays.
Yeah. And they've got decent talent on the outside, like a couple decent receivers. And Carolina's the number 8 pick, which means they're not going to get their dream quarterback this year.
Right.
Denver's another one, you know, at 9. Denver's one I could see going for it because Elway's been on the quarterback hunt since Peyton Manning was there, and he's never found it.
Yeah, and this would be a way to definitely not be wrong. You know what I mean? He's had several bites at the apple, and he's screwed them all up.
Yeah.
But if they have the firepower to make a deal like that, you know, and they're a team with intriguing tons of young talent at receiver, a good young tight end in Noah Fant, running backs that they've invested in, that would be a pretty cool situation to land in.
And a coach who is well recognized as one of the best defensive coaches in the league. I don't know what their defensive talent is exactly like right now because they've had some injuries and things, but Fangio is brilliant.
Yeah, right. I mean, when they're healthy, you've got Nick Chubb, late career Von Miller, you know, there are some dudes that are intriguing. Yeah, I could see it, man. I could see Elway. I could see the Raiders. I don't think the Jets will do it. I think the Jets would
do something like put a sort of lowball offer on the table.
Yeah.
And then just say, this is here, but we're not like, we're not playing
this
by
is here,
goals.
But we're not
playing
gonna by like
ours because we can go two directions. Yeah. We can get Watson and accelerate the rebuild by 2 years.
Yeah.
Or we can sit tight, get the second best quarterback in the draft and reload across the board. So, you know,
right.
your pick, you
That's
know.
Right. Exactly.
I really think if anybody trades for Watson, it's not going to be a rebuilding team. Truly. It's going to be a team that thinks they are Deshaun Watson away from the playoffs, a la Denver or Las Vegas. Who will then hurt their future, but it might be worth it because he's 25 years old. He's, I think he's younger than the Bengals quarterback, or like they're within a year of each other, something like that.
Yeah, he's still extremely young. I don't know if this makes sense at all. Again, like, you know, cap and pick issues notwithstanding, but San Francisco, Watson and Shanahan. Watson and all those explosive young skill guys.
I don't think they would do that though, because I think Shanahan likes the idea of
the Shanahan deal is kind of all about hiding a less toolsy quarterback.
Now, of course, when he was the offensive coordinator for Atlanta, that was the year that their offense was unbelievable and they went to the Super Bowl. But with Matt Ryan. But I don't think that they're going to be willing to give up that many assets, especially because their talent pool on defense especially diminished this year. So I think they need their picks, and I think they think their health and a couple picks away from being back in the playoff hunt.
Yeah, no, that's right, absolutely. Well, Pipe, we've gone like an hour and 12 minutes here, man. We're pretty deep into this thing. It's been good to talk sports with you. Kind of harkening back to an old conceit. Any great sports books that you've read recently that you recommend?
So I'm in the middle of one right now, and it's called Basketball, A Love Story. It's an oral history of basketball. Uh-huh. So it's got multiple kind of contributing editors, authors. Jackie McMullen's one of them, just a great sports basketball journalist. And it actually went hand in hand with a documentary that ESPN did on basketball, and they did all these interviews and realized, man, we need to put this into a book. So I don't know how people feel about oral histories. They can kind of ebb and flow. Sections of them are really interesting. Sections of them are like, whatever, we're just going on and on.
Right.
But it's really fascinating. And the way that they look at sort of just the different eras of history. Sometimes they focus on a player. Sometimes they focus on a decision the league made, those kind of things. But it's fun. It's a good one.
That's awesome, man. Dude, I'm taking a deep dive into this pro football league that was around for 2 years in the 70s, the World Football League. And oddly enough, Old School Shirts, a past sponsor of the program, kind of got me into thinking about the World Football League. But there's this author, this guy named Mark Speck, who's done like multiple very research heavy books on the World Football League. And they're not like incredibly written page turners, but they're just incredibly well researched, well interviewed, deep dives into this weirdo little league that had all kinds of interesting people run through it over the course of a year and a half, 2 years. So I've been enjoying his stuff, but,
did you ever read, you read Football for a Buck by Jeff Perlman, right?
Oh, dude, I've read it like two or three times. Okay. Absolutely loved it.
I picked up a copy of that at McKay's, our favorite used bookstore here in town.
Oh yeah.
For like $2.99. And I haven't read it yet, but I think I'm going to in the next few months.
Dude, it's great. It's classic Perlman in that, you know, you talk about sports books either falling into like great writing or great research. Perlman does both things really well. He's a really good interviewer. He's a really above average writer. He writes a really fun, angly sports book. You know, and I think that's where a lot of practitioners of nonfiction go wrong is that they have either a lazy angle or no angle. And they don't, and in doing so, they don't manage to pull out like the personal stories that really drive, a reading experience. Yeah. But yeah, Perlman does a great job at that. He's done it with almost every book that he's written. And, this one, you're going to enjoy it.
Cool.
It'll be a lot of fun. And, yeah, I'll be curious to see what you think of it when you're done with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, Pipe, we have done what we always do on this program, in that we have wandered to and fro throughout some NFL stuff, some NBA stuff. I need to do my NBA and baseball homework so that for next time we can dovetail into those sports.
Man, the NBA is so weird this year because they just got out of the bubble like a week and a half ago, and then there's already guys missing games and weeks because of COVID safety protocols. So it's just like you show up one day and you're like, oh, the Nets are playing great. It's Kevin Durant. Nope, he's out this week because he was near somebody with COVID. So it's
it sucks, man.
Yeah, it's really uneven. So like the great teams sucks. From last year sort of have a bit of a hangover. And some of the bad teams look frisky, but you're like, but they still suck. Like their talent's not good. So it's a weird season so far.
You know what I need, dude? I need to find a reason to care about it.
Here's your reason.
Yeah.
Ja Morant.
There we go.
He's injured right now. It's an ankle sprain. He's not out for the season. But the fact that you live, like, Memphis is the closest professional basketball team. You have no other ties.
Yeah.
And he is insanely fun to watch. And a great person too.
I know, man. They love him in Memphis, and we love him. But like, to me, it was so fun. I used to always take the boys to Memphis a few times a year for a Grizzlies game, and we used to love going to the building and just being there. But like, not being able to go do that, I don't know. It's really put kind of a crimp in my caring about the NBA paradigm. So that's a good one. I need some kind of a compelling reason to care about it and watch it. And I'll try, man. I'll make the effort.
Yeah, of all the teams in the league, so I'm a Minnesota fan, but Memphis has one of the rosters that I think is kind of the most like underrated fun, because John Morant's a legit rising superstar, but then they have Brandon Clark, who's this weird undersized defensive power forward, super athlete. They've got Jaren Jackson, who's out until his knee recovers from an MCL or patella tendon tear or something like that. But he's a fun player as well. Like just
another great dude that they love in Memphis.
So I mean,
Memphis always put likable guys on the floor.
Yeah,
you know, guys that are easy to cheer.
Yeah, when they had Conley and Gasol and Zebo, it was except for Tony Allen, who was, I don't know if he was likable or just like you like to have him on your team kind of thing. But
yeah.
Yeah, they like Memphis. Memphis has a fun young roster when they're healthy.
Totally. We even had Grayson Allen for a minute, who was kind of a likable, like, basketball a-hole from his college career.
Do
we? Yeah. Oh, nice.
Which, I mean, I hate Grayson Allen. So, but
of course,
fun,
if he's not on your team,
fun
you hate
to
him.
Hate.
Totally. Well, I need to get into it. I need to roll up my sleeves. I've done a good job of keeping up with like Mariners hot stove stuff from the off season. So we need to do a baseball pod at some point and talk about off seasons and outlooks going into next year. And man, like, I'm afraid to hope for anything because 2020, but,
my hope for 2021 is that I get to attend one live sporting event.
Well, dude, that's the thing. I miss going to baseball and NBA games so much. I really want to have that back. And even the viewing experience of watching it on TV, like I think when I got baseball league pass last year, I was just so excited to have any live sport going that I, you know, you overlook the fact that it's stupid cardboard cutouts of like people's dogs in the seats. And, you know, it was like, yeah, for 60 games, I can overlook that, whatever. But man, coming into this season, if we have to do another year of cardboard cutouts and stupid piped in crowd noise, It's going to be hard.
Yeah, this is going to sound sacrilegious, but it's like live streaming church, you know?
Yeah,
When things got locked down in March, that first like month and a half was like, all right, you know, I'm going to get up, I'm going to get my coffee, I'm going to do church from home, and it's kind of
I'm just
novel.
Thankful to be able to see my pastor in any context.
Yeah, you know? But then like when we ran the risk of having to lock down again, I was like, I don't want to stare at another screen for another minute. I can't do this. And that's how I feel about the cardboard cutouts of like the Sandlot characters in the stands. I don't want to see it.
No, I hate it. It's depressing. It's more depressing than just empty seats. Dude, to me, give us the empty seats. Give me the ambient noise of the ballpark and be done with it. Don't try to like foist upon us this idea that there's still atmosphere in an empty building. You know, I mean, it's practice. It's a scrimmage. Like if they played their home games at a, you know, some spring training diamond in Scottsdale, Arizona, that would be more interesting than like, you know, the empty ballpark. So, I don't know, man. I just hope it comes back.
Amen.
And we can go see a ball game at some point and hopefully go see a ball game for a team that's sponsoring us, which we had all buttoned up last year.
Use the season tickets to a team that might not exist anymore.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that team in the shape that it was in last year is not going to exist anymore. They were one of the teams that got contracted by the whole, minor league baseball fiasco. So they're saying that there will be pro baseball in Jackson. They're talking like independent ball, frontier league. I don't know what it's going to be, but I've managed to like kind of get myself pretty dialed in with the decision makers or the powers that be in minor league baseball in Jackson. So I feel like when something happens, I'll know about it and I'll let you know.
Man, that'd be fun. I haven't paid that much attention. I'm assuming the Nashville Sounds did not get contracted. I think that would have made the news around here, but
totally. Yeah. I think they're still affiliated. I've got to think they're with somebody who are their affiliates.
They were the Rangers most recently. They used to be Oakland. Yeah, it's funny. They're in the Pacific Coast League, even though we are a long way from the Pacific Coast.
Yeah, just a stone's throw from the Pacific Coast. There's a lot of things about it that don't make sense. And hopefully those things will get ironed out and we will be back in a stadium watching baseball or back in an arena watching NBA sooner rather than later, Pipe. This has been fun, man. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. What are we thinking for a name for the sign off?
Oh man. I think we need to give respect to one of the players or teams that we made a bad call on just to acknowledge our mistake. So you pick which one, but I think that should be the direction. Okay.
Yeah. That's good. One of the players or teams. I'm going to go with a fun name from a team that would be one of the funnest rebuilds.
Great.
So here we go. Pipe, we've done what we always do on this program, in that we have wandered to and fro throughout the world of sports. And until next time, Forrest Lamp.
The Happy Rant is brought to you by Resonate Recordings. If you go to resonaterecordings.com, you can see the full range of services they offer. So if you're considering starting a podcast, they are the ones we recommend going with. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see their prices, to connect with them and ask any questions, and to see what they can do to help you launch, edit, master, and improve your podcast. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see what they can do to help you launch and improve your podcast.
Finding uplifting news in today's headlines is often like searching for a needle in a haystack. At the Story Behind Podcast, we believe in the power of finding heartwarming tales and are happy to share empowering stories with you every week. Hear about how Steve Harvey surprised a dying man on Family Feud with $25,000. Get inspired by the note a waitress received from a patron dining alone. And even hear about how one VIP passenger made a hardworking pilot get emotional before his flight. To start listening to the Story Behind podcast, visit lifeaudio.com or search Story Behind on your favorite podcast platform.